Well, we move now from the person and work of Christ to the meaning of that person and of that work. And it is often said, isn't it, that if Christ is Lord at all, he must be Lord of all. So that's the point that we must not lose hold of. And when we think of Christ and culture, well, first of all, about culture, I mean, the Second Vatican Council said that culture is the non-biological aspect of humanity. It has to do with what human beings think and do, with what they make, and so on. I mean, in the light of some of our modern developments, I wonder whether non-biological is the right term, because, of course, culture may also have to do with directly or indirectly with our biology. But that's another matter. Culture is unique to human beings in some ways. It is very important to human life. And the Bible takes culture very seriously, of course. Charles Kraft, a sort of missiologist from this country, has spoken of the gospel as a receptor-oriented revelation. That is to say, the gospel takes human culture with seriousness, and that the gospel has to be declared to people, brought to people in ways that they can understand and accept, where their worldview even, their idiom, their language, certainly all of those things play a part in how they respond to the gospel. I think that is true, though one would have to say that the gospel also brings a properly critical attitude to culture. So it's not just receptor-oriented, receptor-friendly, but it can also be receptor-critical. I mean, Charles Kraft doesn't say it, but I think we need to say it. And in this connection, I've been influenced, and many other people will have been, with the work of Richard Niebuhr, one of your own great theologians, and his book, Christ and Culture. Do a lot of people know it? A very, very influential book. But to consider some of the categories that Niebuhr mentions in our relationship with culture, there is, first of all, as you may remember, he talks of the Christ who is for culture. And that is, to some extent, what Kraft is saying already. The Christ who is for culture, I take this to mean that the incarnation, in particular, has to do with an affirmation of all that is good in human life. It has to do not only with the valuing of human life from its very beginning to its very end, it has to do with the affirmation of those important human institutions that allow humanity to survive and to flourish. So it will have to do with an affirmation of the human family, of human relationships, of friendship, of even some of the structures of the state. Christ, who is for culture in that sense of what it is important for human beings to flourish. Now, of course, in some societies, there has been an explicit owning of this relationship of Christ to culture. So I quite often speak about this in the British context, where you have a situation where the nation as a whole affirmed the importance of faith and values derived from Christ for national life. for the life of the people as they lived this life together. So at the coronation, for instance, we are in Diamond Jubilee year, but 60 years ago, the Queen promised to uphold the true profession of the gospel, the true profession of the gospel and the laws of God. Well, those are a gospel and law always related, aren't they? That's another subject. very important subject, however. but what that means is, in terms of the affairs of state, is that the gospel is necessary for a proper understanding and a proper development of the institutions of state, in Britain anyway. I was involved in some cases that were brought to the Court of Appeal about discrimination against Christians in Britain. And the judges in their ruling which went against us, by the way, said that they sat as judges of a secular and multi-faith society. Well, whether that's a contradiction in itself, I don't know. But I said then later on in a newspaper article that I was surprised because I thought they sat as judges of the crown. And the crown has promised to uphold the true profession of the gospel. So, you know, which is it? The gospel for a particular culture, where a culture has owned the gospel in for its own life in such a way that the gospel has, to some extent or other, influenced and formed the basic institutions of social and political life. And suddenly in Britain at the moment, we are in danger of turning our backs on all of that. And what a tragedy that will be. Niebuhr, in giving the example of the Christ who's for culture, does not stop at Western examples, by the way. He also gives the example of Ethiopia and also of Armenia as cultures that at a very early stage had owned this possibility of the gospel shaping them and their common life together in one way or another and to one extent or another. One point I think that needs to be made here is that the Christ who is for or of culture, this is not simply an endorsement of culture or about the life of a particular people. You know, sometimes Christian leaders talk about the value of Britishness. Well, there may be a value in Britishness, I'm sure there is, or in Americanness for that matter. But that is quite different from asking what Christ has to do with a culture or with a people. And when we ask that question of Christ for culture, then that must also have to be about the critique that the gospel can bring to national life, so that if, for instance, there are matters of injustice or inequality improper sexual behavior or the jeopardizing of the state of the family or whatever it may be, that the gospel can then bring a proper critique to what is going wrong. And it is not, therefore, must not, therefore, be seen simply as endorsement of the status quo ante. Then the second thing that Niebuhr highlighted was the Christ who is above culture. So Christ cannot simply be reduced to the way in which this or that culture has understood him and his demand, however well that might have been, because there's always the possibility of more. And if we think of the state, for instance, as really ordered according to God's will, and unless a state is totally disordered and particularly tyrannical, there must be elements of order that are divinely willed in the existence of any civic and political arrangements. We can affirm that, but then we can also say, nevertheless, whatever God's will may be for a particular people or a particular nation, there are always those spiritual and moral aspirations that are not simply fulfilled in the natural order. That spiritual side of humanity which needs Christ for fulfillment. And that is one of the reasons why evangelism is successful, is because the bringing of Jesus Christ to people is a fulfilling of what they are aspiring to in any case. and then Niebuhr also thought of the somewhat paradoxical way in which some people divide what Christ means in the institutions of state on the one hand, and on the other what Christ means for a believer. Now, there is a distinction. I don't mean to deny that. What Christ means to someone who has been justified by grace through faith in all that Jesus has done, of course, that is absolutely essential to the beginning of the Christian life and to its continuation. What I think we cannot say and should not say is that relevance of Christ to the believer, that has nothing to do with what Christ means in the ordering of a people and of a nation. Somehow there must be a connection between the justification and sanctification of the believer and how that believer then operates in a society, acknowledging its God-givenness, but also bringing the critique of the gospel to bear on that society. I mean, this is very important, and there has been a danger in some circles since the Reformation of eliding or even denying this connection. Niebuhr talked about the Christ who is against culture. So just as Jesus Christ can be for all that is God-given in culture, there may come times, there do come times, when Christian believers in the name of Christ have to say no. No to what is happening in a particular culture or at a particular time. This has to be carefully thought about. It shouldn't be intemperate, but it does need to be done from time to time. I was looking at some facsimile copies of the libellus, you know, the certificate that that had to be signed in the presence of a magistrate when the early Christians were brought to court. And all they had to do was to say, I have always sacrificed to the gods, signed A.B., and then they could go home. And we know of the hundreds of thousands of martyrs, but of course there were many more people who simply signed these certificates. That is to say, they simply capitulated to the culture. And those who did not, well, they were only asked, you know, there was only one question. Are you a Christian? And that itself was enough to condemn them to death. So, in certain situations, Christ can be against what the state demands or what culture values. And we have to learn to say no in certain circumstances. In terms of the Church of England, and the Episcopal Church may not be too different here, the Church of England has been very strong in a pastoral mode. That is to say, you know, the hatching, matching, dispatching mode. And that work has gone on quietly, invisibly, almost, in society, aiding in the cohesiveness of many communities, therefore. I like to think of it, and I may have said this before, as the salt metaphor. You know, the salt is not easily visible when it is in food, but it is very necessary. It not only provides taste, but also nourishment. I have a continuing debate with Valerie about salt as a nutrient. I mean, I strongly hold to the view that it is a nutrient. I think she meant, it's also a preserver, and all of those things. And that's fine. I mean, that is one way, a gospel, an evangelical way, if you like, of thinking of the Christian and of the church. But in Britain, certainly, and you may want to say here, certainly in many other parts of the world, it may be that we need to change the metaphor from salt to light. See, light is by its very nature visible. Jesus said, didn't he, you know, you are the light of the world. People don't light a candle or a lamp and then hide it under a tub or a table or wherever, but put it on a lampstand where everyone can see the light. I mean, the question is whether we should move as Anglicans from the salt metaphor to the light metaphor. And as Jesus said, the light then dispels the darkness. And as we live in a world of encroaching darkness, whether that is from extremist Islamism or aggressive secularism, all those things that Bishop Mark was talking about, do we now need, rather than a sense of dispersed and diffuse mission, a more concentrated view of mission which sees the Christian community as a light that attracts those in the darkness by the clarity of its light? I mean, I think that's it's a kind of paradigm shift, if you like, that we are facing. But Niebuhr had already seen this in 1950 or whenever the book was published. And then Niebuhr talks about Christ as the transformer of culture. So it is not just culture as it is. It's not even culture in the ways in which it may be fallen, but as the one who changes culture. And I have become more and more interested in recent years in the work that David Martin has done, for instance, Anglican sociologist, on the way in which Pentecostalism is changing South America and Africa. He has now been joined by two young friends of ours. We're going to stay with them on our way back, who work in Washington, Timothy Shah and Rebecca Shah, his wife, who have been showing how Christ transforms people who are deprived, people in cultures that have been oppressed by others for a very long time. Now, David Martin has shown in his work on Pentecostalism in South America that what liberation theology was trying to do, which was to liberate people and to improve their social and economic situation, liberation theology was unable to do because it did not take the spiritual seriously. But Pentecostalism is doing, because it is taking the spiritual seriously, and it is creating, therefore, a cycle of virtue. So what happens is that a man is converted, so he doesn't any longer go out with his mates and gets drunk every night. He therefore doesn't beat his wife up. He stays at home so the children do their homework and do better at school, therefore. The employers trust them because they are more honest. The status of women in society improves. And as I say, an atmosphere of virtue is created that he believes will become hugely important for what happens to nations like Brazil, where maybe 30% of the population is now Pentecostal. Now, Rebecca and Timothy have done similar work, for example, among untouchables in India. A particular group, the Nadars, untouchables, who were converted to Christian faith, and the faith has changed their social and economic situation to such an extent that the higher castes, who despised them before, now come to them for education and health training and all of these things. So Christ is the transformer of culture. You see. that's Niebuhr. Archbishop David Gitari, I don't know if you remember him, he was the Archbishop of the church in Kenya. In a very important address to the 1988 Lambeth Conference, spoke of what Christ meant to the culture of his people when the gospel came to them. And he pointed out that there were some things that the coming of the gospel of Christ enriched and enhanced and affirmed. So one of the things he mentioned was the idea of Ubuntu in Africa, so common, of people finding their own identity in a social context, which is summed up with the, you know, I am because we are idea. And this, he says, was affirmed by the gospel. Creativity, he pointed to research that showed that the coming of Christianity resulted in an explosion of creativity, for example, in the arts in Africa. Spontaneity in worship, the strengthening of communities, I mean, many, many things that the gospel affirmed and enhanced in African life. Secondly, he said there were some things that were not affected at all by the coming of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So, for instance, what people ate, whether you eat ugali, which is the staple in East Africa, or sausage and mash, or whatever it is you ate. I had some excellent sausage of Bishop Mark's this morning for breakfast, by the way. I must find out where he gets them. You know, the gospel doesn't say anything about that. Now, we may find this unremarkable, but actually, in relationship to Islam, it is quite remarkable, because Islam is very precise about what it says people can eat and what they cannot eat and so on. Then thirdly, he, and more controversially, he spoke of what the gospel can allow for the time being, for a generation, whilst the gospel is changing people. And there were two examples he gave. One was the custom among his people of women and men never sitting together in a public meeting. So if you, that doesn't just mean that they sat separately at the same meeting, but you had to have different public meetings for them. Now, his point was that as people grew in the grace of the gospel and in Christ, there being no male nor female and so forth, that this would come to an end, but it didn't mean that it had to be ended immediately. The other example that he gave, of course, was polygamy. The custom of the missionaries in the early days had been to insist on a man giving up all but one of his wives if he was to be baptized. And he said that the result of this was the impoverishment of a great number of women and possibly even the falling into prostitution and other kinds of social evil for them. And so what he was saying was that the church should accept polygamous families as they are for baptism, provided that the next generation is not polygamous, and so on. And then the fourth thing that was the, what the gospel could not at all accept in a culture. And in his culture, from his culture, he gave two examples. One was the practice of cattle rustling. I mean, in that part of Africa, there are some people who believe that all the cattle in the world belong to them. So if they take your cow, it's not really stealing, because it's theirs anyway. Now, he said, you know, the gospel could not accept that. And the other was the practice of the killing of twins, because the twins were regarded as a curse. If they were born, they had to be killed. The gospel could not accept that. Now, Guattari has been criticized for some of these things that he said. I mean, the Ubuntu idea, I'm in touch with a South African independent Pentecostal pastor who says, well, Ubuntu is fine if it works with the grain of the gospel, if it leads to a whole community accepting the gospel. But what happens if the whole community get together and prevent someone from accepting the gospel? What happens then? He's also been criticized for saying that there is no real trajectory of monogamy in the Bible. I don't think that can be maintained. If you read the creation narratives, the continual emphasis of the prophets on faithfulness, the teaching of Jesus himself and Paul and so forth. Nevertheless, I think Guattari is an important example of how people have to wrestle with the question of Christ and culture, each in their own context, of course. Religion is one of the most important features of culture, even if it cannot wholly be identified with culture. And we have to ask, therefore, what Christ has to do with this aspect of culture. And just to say very quickly, we must be clear that the Bible has no place and no time for false religion. False religion is always condemned in the Bible. Norman Gottwald, the great sociologist of the Old Testament, pointed out that it was the belief in the oneness of God, the Yahwism of early Israel, that led to its egalitarianism, its belief in equality. And it was this that led to the Israelite resistance of oppressive and exploitative cultures like the Canaanite, with their priest-king axis, which exploited the people and were contrary to the egalitarianism of Israel. We can also say this about the rejection, for instance, of the Baal cults. The Baal cults were rejected, of course, for their sexual promiscuity, whether heterosexual or homosexual, because in this promiscuity there was not a proper respect for persons. So persons were used as ends, as means to our ends, and not ends in themselves. Nevertheless, in the Bible, there are also many examples of righteous Gentiles. Just to give one example, Melchizedek, who appears very early on in Genesis 14. Melchizedek is actually a Canaanite priest king. You know, the very thing that the Bible is concerned elsewhere to reject. And he appears with bread and wine and sacramental symbols, of course. And Abraham, the patriarch of the faithful, in whose loins is Levi, makes an offering of a tithe to Melchizedek. I mean, you know, who is Melchizedek? Well, there is later reflection in the Bible on Melchizedek, particularly about the Messiah, a psalm that Jesus himself refers to, which speaks of the Messiah's priesthood. You are a priest forever, not according to the order of Aaron, but of the order of Melchizedek. And the author of the letter to the Hebrews, of course, develops this greatly. There are many such examples that can be given. Job, of course, the people of Nineveh, Naaman the Syrian, and Ruth, the ancestress not only of David, but of the Messiah himself, and so forth. There is also already in the Bible a sense of God's providential working with people of all cultures and nations. This is both in the past. So in the prophet Amos, we are told that the God who brought the Israelites out of Egypt, is also the one who has a providential care for Israel's traditional enemies, the Syrians and the Philistines, and even the Ethiopians, who were regarded as people who were the furthest away, if you like. God does honor whatever is known of him and is acknowledged of him in Malachi chapter 1, when the Israelites are being criticized for bringing false worship. The Israelites are being criticized for the false worship of God, dishonorable, dishonoring him. The prophet then says, "And yet my name is honored among the Gentiles." Now, I've struggled with this verse a long time. In the early church, it was thought of as a prophecy of the Eucharist, which we will be celebrating, of course, quite soon. But there is no futurity in the Hebrew. I mean, the Hebrew is actually about what is happening. And then, of course, there is the future, how God is fulfilling his purposes. And so Isaiah 19... where God says, "Blessed be Egypt, my people." It's still very popular, that verse, unsurprisingly, in Egypt. Both Christians and Muslims have referred to it in my presence. "Blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria," that other great enemy, "Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my heritage." So God's universal purposes, eventually, of course, revealed in Jesus Christ, are there being worked out in the lives of nations and of cultures. Now, this may not necessarily mean religions, by the way. Sometimes this may be in countercultural movements, in perceptions of justice or equity. I've often seen, for example, Buddhism, the rise of Buddhism and Sikhism, as movements that arose within Hinduism to challenge the caste system and its oppressiveness. And you know, many other examples can be given of how what God's will is for people can be apprehended by them and therefore be a preparation for the gospel. This story continues with Jesus, where he found a response among the most unlikely people, those who were on the margins, and particularly those who were foreigners, whether it's the Samaritans, the Roman centurion whose servant was ill, and that, by the way, was the occasion in Matthew for Jesus saying, "And many will come from east and west and sit at table with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob." You know, the great kind of universal vision. And it continues in the story of the early church. The preaching of Paul at Athens is an example, but also the story of Peter and Cornelius and so on. In the early church, by the way, the apologists, the early apologists, Justin Martyr, for example, often began with the revelation in Christ as giving us the capacity to criticize what was wrong in our culture and what is wrong in religion. That was the emphasis. But they also saw that people were able to be critical of their culture or of their religion because of the illumination of the divine word. So the Logos, becoming incarnate in Christ in St. John's Gospel, is the divine word that illumines people in their criticism of their paganism or of the injustice around them or whatever it may be. That's the first use of the Logos in this context. But then they also go on to see that it is possible, because of the illumination of this Logos, to see truth. In Plato and in Socrates, for example, for them very often, in the poetry and the philosophy and the morality of the Stoics, and even in some pagan oracles, like the Sibylline oracles. which were seen as prophesying about the coming of Christ. Now, what I'm trying to say is that when we are relating Christ to religion, we must confront what is false, and we do see what is false. But we can also affirm what remains through natural apprehension of the natural world, through the testimony of conscience, and even from time to time what Calvin called special revelation, which may be half forgotten, but nevertheless can still assist people in some response to the God whom they may not know clearly, but nevertheless know about, even in a state of waywardness and rebellion. Of course, for the evangelist, this is an opportunity to bring to them the wholeness of the gospel. I mean, that is one of the reasons, of course, for evangelists taking people's spiritual beliefs very seriously. And the best missionaries have also understood religion as important in that sense. Two contemporary problems, and then I will sit down, about this. Some people are saying that it is possible to be a follower of Christ within another religious tradition. Is this the case? Is it possible? Now, I am not denying that there are many people in this world who are secret believers, who cannot, because of their political and social circumstances, declare their faith in Jesus Christ. I know a number of them. I respect them and I pray for them. And I'm sure they pray for me as well. They are continually praying that God will give them the freedom to declare this faith that they have. This is not what is at issue. What is at issue is a form of mission thinking that claims that you can be a follower of Christ whilst also being a Muslim, for example. I mean, this is very fashionable in evangelical circles. I'm not talking about liberals or anything like that. There is Mazhar Maluhi, a Syrian Muslim who became a Christian, tried to join the Arab Christian churches, found that he wasn't accepted by them, and has now reverted to being a Muslim follower of Jesus. He has written some very interesting books in this area, a commentary on St. John's Gospel from the Sufi point of view, which is very suggestive, and is highly acceptable to Muslims when he speaks to them about the Bible. I mean, that's the positive side of it. But the question is, about him in particular, what will follow? Once he goes, I mean, we are all mortal, what remains then? What witness will remain? Secondly, is it possible for a follower of Christ to say, for example, the Muslim ritual prayer? Now, Phil Parshall, great missionary in Bangladesh, from America, I've had a sort of many duels with Phil about this kind of thinking over many, many years. But he now says that he tried to take part in the Muslim ritual prayer, but the words stuck in his throat, and that he won't do it again. It's not because I said so, but because God said so, very importantly. Well, that's the crunch. I mean, as I was saying earlier, the Surah Al-Ikhlas, Surah 112, is an ordinary part of the Muslim ritual prayer. Say, Allah is one, He does not beget, nor is He begotten. Can a Christian say, I mean, a follower of Christ say that? So there is that, you know, how can you hold these contradictions together? But then, finally on this one, will Muslims allow such a following of Christ? See, I have for a long time been concerned for the human rights of a group in Pakistan called the Ahmadiyya, who are, from our point of view, Muslims, but regarded by Sunnis as heterodox and have been declared non-Muslim, and are not allowed to use the word mosque, to say the Muslim profession of faith, to issue the call of prayer, any of these things, on pain of prison or fine or both. Now, if Muslims are not going to allow people who look to us like Muslims to do any of these things, are they going to allow Christians or followers of Jesus or whatever you call them? So that's the first question. The second that I want to leave with you is whether religious traditions as a whole can be transformed by Christ. This was a question that was raised in a very sharp way by a very illustrious predecessor of mine at the Church Missionary Society, Bishop John V. Taylor, who later became Bishop of Winchester. Whether Christ is changing religious tradition. He had in mind Hinduism. It is undoubtedly true that Hinduism as we see it today is unrecognizable from how it was 200 years ago. In terms of the status of women, belief in the oneness of God, the abolition of the caste system in modern India, and you know, many examples can be given. And modern Hindu reformers have explicitly, at least some of them, owned their debt to Christ for this. So Raja Ram Mohan Roy, in the abolition of sati, the practice of widow burning, for instance, Rabindranath Tagore, the great poet, Mahatma Gandhi, whose whole program of passive resistance was formed by his reading of St. Matthew's Gospel. And the question is whether Hinduism can continue to be transformed by Christ in this way. Bishop Kenneth Cragg, now 97, an old teacher of mine, examiner, everything, his whole life's work is dictated by his idea that Christ has to be commended to Muslims according to the logic of Islam. All his books are really about that, how to commend Christ according to the logic of Islam. Well, is it possible? I mean, I have huge respect for Kenneth, and I've learned more than I can say from him. But in the end, I have to say, in the end, and I think he might say this as well in his better moments, that Christ cannot be commended according to the logic of Islam. You can use that logic to some extent, but there comes a time when the logic will prevent you from going further. Now, those are two very important questions about Christ and the religions with which we have to grapple in a missionary age, in a missionary world, and I leave those with you. So Christ and culture, Christ and the religions, how the Christ who has been shown to be Lord in his person and through his work needs to be shown through our mission to be Lord of culture, and to be Lord of those of any and every religion, and indeed of none. Thank you very much, Bishop.
Why don't we take two or three questions? Yes, right there.
I was so reminded by a story when, Bishop, you were saying that God can move in other cultures or other religions, and people can know Christ through the movement of God, even though he may not be recognizable immediately to them. My parents were missionaries to Korea when I was a child. And one of their best friends was an evangelist who went down to the boondocks. And he went into a little village where they had never seen white people before. And he was third generation, so he was very fluent in the language. And he told the good news of Jesus Christ. And there was this ancient old lady who was weeping as he was talking. And he went up to her and said, "Grandmother, why are you crying?" And she said, "I've known him all my life. You have just told me his name."
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, well, this is not a question, but I think it is absolutely right that when the gospel is brought to people, they are able to recognize it as a fulfillment of their deepest aspirations, provided they're not prevented by the religious hierarchy or the state or whatever it may be, that they can connect with the good news of Jesus Christ. The story told about Sadhu Sundar Singh, you know, that who was a great a Christian leader in India, who'd become a Christian through reading the Bible, and his family were very hard on him, very hard, threw him out and everything. But when he was at the height of his ministry, somebody asked him, "Sadhuji," they said, you know how they talk in India, "Sadhuji," they said, "when you go to heaven and find that your mother is not there, what will you do?" And he thought about it for a while, and then he said, "I will ask to be taken to the place where she is." Because he saw, we've got a friend, Valerie and I have got a friend who has become a Christian from a Sikh background. Again, very difficult circumstances, but she was telling me the other day how what her parents had told her about God led her to make sense of the gospel when it was presented to her. Because she said, yes, this is actually what it was about. And she accepted the gospel. The parents were not convinced, obviously, but she was, and she is now hoping to show her parents how the gospel fulfills their deepest aspirations. I have never met anyone who has come to Christ from another religion who has denied that there was anything of truth or value from where they have come. Of course, there are many things that have to be set aside and rejected. But there's also been a very real sense in how God has been leading them through what they were doing, even sometimes reading the Quran or being in a mosque, to Christ. I think we just have to take that very seriously.
Thank you, Bishop. Concerning Christ as the transformer of culture, I can easily relate to that as a person, native Liberian, and I just published my dissertation with early missionary work of the Episcopal Church in Liberia in the early 1800s. One of the things that the missionaries from here, the Episcopal missionaries implanting the church in Liberia did that was very hurtful to the natives and the tradition there was the fact of asking them to deny their culture in light of polygamy, in light of consulting the oracle or whatever you would call it, in light of respecting the elders and everything else. And in light of doing that, part of what my research and my own experiences discover is the fact that the church did not flourish in those places where they went and condemned the people's culture and said everything that they did was not right. And my findings in light of that was the church did not grow in Liberia in light of that, because they were condemning everything that the people had done there and said, unless you became Christian, unless you wore Western clothes, unless you abandoned the otherwise you had, just as you mentioned. So I thought I just want to share that with you all. Thank you.
Yeah, well, we have a lot to repent of, obviously. But this is not just true of Liberia. I mean, this has been true in many different contexts. There's a very fine book by a Dutchman called Anton Wessels, Was Europe Ever Really Christian? And, it's worth reading. It's a great read. But basically, Wessels sets out in this book the two approaches to mission in Europe. One was that of Gregory the Great and Augustine in England. Augustine was a very timorous missionary. He was constantly asking Gregory for advice about what to do with this horrible barbarian people that he had been sent to deal with, meaning the English, of course. Gregory would send him advice, and particularly about what to do about their pagan practices, their pagan places of worship and so forth. And Gregory's advice to Augustine was, don't destroy everything. Take it and purify it and use it for Christian service. So particularly, many of our cathedrals are built on ancient Druid sites because that is how they were used. But there was another tradition exemplified by the English missionary to the Germans. You know, the Germans were converted by the English. They don't like to admit this, but Boniface, whose way of dealing with things was to destroy everything and start again. And this is a constant tension. Now, it is very difficult to decide in advance what should be destroyed and what not. Take drumming. You know, the missionary's discouragement of drumming. Now, to us it looks silly. I mean, I've got a son who's a drummer. And I sometimes wish that some missionary would come. And I don't mean that. But the fact was that drumming in many cultures was associated with calling on evil spirits. So the missionaries were unable to distinguish drumming as a musical kind of art form from this invocation of spirits. Well, polygamy we have discussed. Again, I think it was a mistake to demand that people should give up their wives before baptism. It led to many of them becoming Muslims, by the way, also, because Islam did not demand that, does not demand it. However, at some stage, the demand of the gospel, I mean, it is absolutely central to the biblical testimony, to a properly biblical understanding of humanity, that man and woman have been made together, and as Barth said, together in the image of God. And that belonging of the one to the other is unique and exclusive. That is what we are battling with now in a different context in the West. So how we decide what in culture is to be affirmed or purified or corrected and what cannot be is a difficult missionary task in every situation. I mean, we constantly have to struggle with
it. One final question.
I wanted to ask you a question about the church today, but as a prelude to that, I wanted to tell you an experience I had about 40 years ago in Guatemala. And we had gone inside one of the churches there, which was naturally a Catholic church. And there was a funeral going on. And it's about the acceptance of the pagan way with religion in order to accept this and meld it. And at this funeral, the people who were related to the person who had died brought a dead chicken, which is not particularly pastoral, but they accepted it. But my question is, since I moved here 20 years ago now, I am really overwhelmed by the growth of these enormous evangelical churches. I take Seacoast as an example. They are popping up like mushrooms after the rain. And I'm wondering if maybe our faith started changing when Christ was born. And if maybe we are in a very important period within our faith where our faith is growing in order to accept the community, which perhaps we as Episcopalians are not accepting in the way we should accept it. And maybe that's what these evangelical churches are providing, because I've met several people who go to Seacoast who've invited me to come to Seacoast. And I say, well, why do you love it so much? What's so different about Seacoast? Well, it's our life. And I don't know how many of us can say that about our church.
Mm. Yes, thank you. I mean, about the Guatemala thing, well, I've had goats brought to me and all sorts of things. I mean, goats and dead chickens are no different from a $5 or a $10 note, really. I mean, if it's offered in that sense. I mean, on the question of churches mushrooming or sprouting up like mushrooms, my bishop in my early days as a priest, when I expressed my worries about this kind of thing to him, he said, look, there are flash floods and there is the still water that flows underneath. And don't be too taken up by the flash floods, because they'll come and go. But what you need is the apostolic faith that remains. Now, of course, the question for Episcopalian and for Anglicans generally is whether we do have the apostolic faith and whether we retain it. The apostolic ministry, which we do have, as I was saying to Mere Anglicanism, the Anglicanism has kept together the need for a sacred deposit and a sacred ministry. And the sacred ministry is not the master of the deposit, but its servant. Nevertheless, the two belong together and are for the sake of each other, for the sake of keeping the apostolic faith. If we do that, I think we will be able to face all these different movements that arise and that will, in due course, disappear. There are many young evangelicals who want to be Anglican because they see this balance of word and sacrament, of word and ministry. But of course the stumbling block to it is our own uncertainty and our own teaching that is contrary to the gospel. And that doesn't commend us and does not assure people that we really retain that apostolic teaching.